So I am here. I have the great privilege of talking to Graham Hancock, who is the best-selling author of Fingerprints of the Gods, Supernatural, and most recently, the War God fantasy trilogy. Graham, your book Supernatural is really the first thing that made me realize I had to search out ayahuasca. And it allowed me to conduct my own sort of self-initiation into the medicine. And this has impacted my own fiction work with my graphic novel Kali Yuga and other fiction works that I have forthcoming very significantly. And one of the things I wanted to ask...
When you say impacted, your work with the medicine has impacted your creative work, yes?
Yes, very much so, yes. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is, do you still participate in ayahuasca ceremonies? I know recently on social networks you've said that you've had about 50 sessions now and you're not vomiting nearly as much, so you're sort of past the initial cleansing stage. And then do you feel like this experience has impacted you creatively?
In answer to the first question, yes, I do still participate in ayahuasca ceremonies. As a matter of fact, I have not done so since January, February of 2013. My practice has been to have about 5 ayahuasca ceremonies a year, and I've kept that up fairly regularly over the last decade or so. I find that 5 sessions within a 2-week period is a good structure to work with ayahuasca, and I don't find that I need more than that in the course of a year. I haven't arranged ceremonies yet for 2014, and it may be that I will take a year off in 2014 because I've got a whole lot of other things on my plate at the moment, and finding those 2 weeks to go down to Brazil and drink ayahuasca may be difficult in 2014. Mm-hmm. But in the longer term, I intend to continue this yearly work and continue doing ideally about 5 sessions of ayahuasca a year. I feel it's a very important part of my life. I feel I've learned a lot from it and that I still have a lot to learn from it, and therefore I absolutely intend to continue. What I have done since January 2013 is I've had a number of sessions with Changa, which is a smoked form of DMT, and DMT is the active ingredient of ayahuasca, and that has been certainly extremely interesting, but perhaps not as deeply spiritually nourishing and instructive as the ayahuasca work is.
Right. Well, one of the things you say in your articles on your website, Letters from the Far Side of Reality, is that you feel there is a certain nourishing quality that the vine brings you with entering the DMT space, and that without that quality or the presence and the guiding aspect of the vine, that you feel almost a bit vulnerable, and many people have reported this as well.
Sure. DMT, I tend to describe it as a rocket ship to the other side of reality. Mm-hmm. You know, ayahuasca is a bit more of a gentle walk to the other side of reality.
Right.
And it can be disconcerting to be immersed suddenly within 2 or 3 seconds in a completely other realm, which is what smoke DMT tends to do. But I must say my experiences with Changa, which is DMT mixed with some monoamine oxidase inhibitor leaves, as a matter of fact, it's a very interesting smoke, and I found it gentle and healing and positive, and you know, really quick. I mean, you're in and out in 5 or 6 minutes in the case of Changa.
Mm-hmm.
So it's less of a mission than ayahuasca, and I tend to continue the work with Changa as well. But there's really no substitute for the full scale immersion in the ayahuasca journey. You have to prepare yourself for it. You have to brace yourself to a certain extent. It's certainly not all sweetness and light. There are challenges. There are difficulties, but that's an important part of the learning process.
Sure.
And I still feel I have a lot of work to do in that school, so I will be back.
Sure. One of the other things that struck me about that article is the depiction of the archetypal character whom you call the magician, which mm-hmm. you say has a distinct male presence. Could you get into this a bit more? Does that character play at all a factor in your fiction and storytelling work?
I sometimes call him the trickster as well. It's interesting. With ayahuasca, generally, but there are a number of entities that I've encountered in the ayahuasca space, but the most direct personal encounter has been with the entity that I construe as Mother Ayahuasca. Now, you know, I have to qualify immediately. We don't know what these entities are, and we have to accept the possibility, which many materialist scientists would insist upon, that they are merely projections of our own mind, and that they have no external reality separate from ourselves. That's not my view. That's the view of materialist science. My own view is I think they do have an external reality, but I can't prove that. All I can say is that the level of experience, that's what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
The most frequent encounter has been with definitely a female entity who sometimes takes the form of a human form as a woman, sometimes as a serpent, a gigantic serpent who once wrapped herself completely around my body and rested a huge head on my shoulder and just looked into my eyes and told me that I needed to learn to love myself a little bit more. And sometimes in a feline form as a jaguar or a panther. I've had encounters with this entity in all of those forms, and she always seems to be the same entity to me, which I construe as the spirit behind the ayahuasca vine. But from time to time, much more strongly with smoked DMT, and there I'm talking about the pure form of smoked DMT, not Changa, I have had these rather scary encounters with a figure that I think of as a magician or a trickster who kind of performs tricks and does these strange arm movements in front of me. I'm a bit afraid of him. I don't know quite what he is or what he's for. And you know, I'm so immersed in that realm when I encounter him that there's not a part of me which is saying, "This'll be okay. I'll be out of here soon." I do very, very much feel the reality of that encounter, and I'm not sure where it leads, but so far it's not done me any harm, I have to say. It's just a little frightening, perhaps because it's so alien. I say alien not in the sense of extraterrestrial beings, but just completely different from anything that we normally encounter in everyday life, and that's always a little bit scary. But in terms of information content and in terms of teaching, there's no doubt to me that a lengthy ayahuasca session is a far superior medium to smoke DMT. There's a lot more work to be done in that session.
Hmm. One of the things I'm interested in getting into is, do you feel your experiences with ayahuasca have contributed to some of your shift in transitioning into the fiction world of storytelling as opposed to the nonfiction of, say, supernatural?
Yes, absolutely, definitely, without a shadow of a doubt. That's the case. I've been put on a fiction track, which I don't think I would have explored at all. I don't think I would have had the courage or the impulse to explore it if it hadn't been for ayahuasca. It's really very, very interesting because writing fiction for me is quite a different exercise from writing nonfiction. With nonfiction, I have a plan. I have a huge volume of research that I'm drawing upon. I'm thinking in terms of argument and reason. I'm thinking, how will somebody who is deeply opposed to this idea, it might be an idea about alternative history, how will they react to what I'm saying here, and how can I counter the arguments that will be put up? So it's a very it's a very rational, inquiring process, and I definitely do have a plan in mind for the whole book when I begin to write it. In the case of fiction writing, it's quite different. I find that any attempt to actually write down a plan or a structure for the book that I'm going to write inhibits and narrows what I can do. That it's much better just to plunge my characters into a situation and then see how the situation evolves as I'm writing it. And therefore, it is for me a much more creative process. I honestly don't know what's going to happen at the end of a particular chapter or even at the end of a particular paragraph. And things constantly surprise me. It's as though I'm discovering this story as I go along, rather than that I'm putting down in a more lengthy form something that I've already prepared in note form. And that's very exciting, that things happen that I didn't expect, and that I must then dance and dive around the problems in the story that are created by those things happening. I've got to keep on moving and adjusting, and the story can go in a completely different direction than I might have imagined that it went in. And this creative process is very different from the process of writing a non-fiction book as far as I'm concerned. And as I said a moment ago, I don't think I would have got into it without ayahuasca. It was very specifically a series of ayahuasca sessions, again, five sessions over 2 weeks in Brazil, that gave me the impulse to write fiction. And that was the first novel that I ever wrote, which was a novel called Entangled, which is a time slip novel with one heroine in the 21st century and one 24,000 years ago in the Stone Age. And I was, in a sense, given a vision of this story. I wasn't given a structure, I wasn't given a plan. I was given the dilemma, the situation, the characters, the notion of a battle of good against evil played out over the frame of time. And then I went back and began to work it out as a story. And it was a revelation to me that I could write fiction at all. I didn't know that I could do that. I'd never done it before. But I found that I could. So I would say that I was given a creative boost and a creative blessing, in a way, by working with ayahuasca. And I note that others in different fields, for example, artists, I can't paint or draw anything. I have absolutely no visual gifts whatsoever. But those who work with ayahuasca, they find that the direction of their work is taken off in a wholly new form as well. So this seems to be a universal phenomenon. I've heard of scientists who've had creative input to their science explorations through drinking ayahuasca. It's a mystery. I don't know why it works that way, but the creative faculty within us, whatever it is, can be nourished by the ayahuasca experience.
Yeah, Jimmy Weisskopf says a bit about this in his book, Yahe, the New Purgatory, and he also says that most of visionary shamanic storytelling in the West can be traced after Dante's Inferno, that model mm-hmm. of visionary yep. storytelling. And I think it's that ayahuasca communicates to the global brain. It's communicating to the left and right brain simultaneously, and in symbols, yeah. symbols, mythical images tend to be the primary way that it communicates. Yeah. And as Thomas B. Roberts says, that this is really very different from the alert problem-solving consciousness that you have also said, which he calls the default state of consciousness.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too, because in mainstream media, it seems that they are picking up on the idea of positive representation of entheogens.
Yes.
In the recent film Noah, the main character experiences a kind of prophetic vision of the end of the world, mm-hmm. and it's given to him in this mud-like tea, by the character of Anthony Hopkins.
Right.
And recently on Hannibal, they had a very interesting look into sort of a psilocybin initiation mm-hmm. that seemed to be very grounded in some scientific ideas and some, right. you know, deep-rooted psychological ideas as well.
I understand ayahuasca has found its way into the series called Da Vinci's Demons as well.
Yes.
So, you know, yeah, it's getting out there into popular culture.
Yes.
And I celebrate that. I think it's a good I think it's a good thing. There's been a fear in Hollywood and in the media, quite a profound fear until quite recently, in dealing in a positive way with anything to do with psychedelics, with entheogens. So I regard it as a step forward, even if from time to time they trivialize the issues, if they're willing to embrace that and explore it, because we need to get away from this fear that has been imposed upon us all over the world, as a matter of fact, that somehow the notion of working with psychedelics has been demonized and rendered to be a fearful thing. So anything that brings it into a less fearful space, a space that we're willing to explore, a space of adventure, a space of exploration. I think that's a really good development, and I can only see good things coming out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it will be the artist's responsibility to give it, well, both the artist's and scholar's responsibility to give it a deep, grounding kind of, you know, nonfiction incorporation, insights, and deep, serious study that,
yeah.
you know, reflect what is going on with the main,
yeah.
with the mainstream culture. In Gabriel D. Roberts' book, The Quest of Gnosis, you say that there seems to be a new type of shaman developing in the West. Many people feel that neo-shamanism, you know, has received a lot of critiques in academic and in popular culture, too. Do you think that this is something to do with the resurgence of interest in psychedelic medicines, you know, best represented by the documentaries DMT, The Spirit Molecule, and also the recent documentary Neurons to Nirvana? And yeah. if so, if this does have to do with psychedelic medicine, how do you feel that, how do you see this new shaman character developing, and how can we in the West sort of take a less superficial kind of, I think there's the idea almost in Burning Man a little bit that psychedelic culture is almost like an endless party, but I feel also too that there is a deeper sense of people who are self-initiating into shamanic mysteries in the comfort of their own home,
yeah,
and who are having very deep cathartic spiritual experiences. And you know, it's trivialized a little bit in Western media and with newspapers and things like that. But how do you see this developing, and how can
First of all, the endless party notion of psychedelics, I think, is very much on its way out.
Mm.
I think it's on its way out with youth culture, which is where it matters. Yes, it was there at one time, but what I see, I have an enormous amount of young people, and when I say young people, I mean people maybe 18 to 25 years old, who are in contact with me through social networks, through my author Facebook page, through my personal Facebook page, so on and so forth, who are firing questions at me. And what I find in those questions is a lot of deep thought going on, a lot of really serious inquiry going on around the issue of psychedelics, a feeling that there's important work to be done, that this isn't a party, that this is about our evolution as individuals, and as a species, as a matter of fact. I get very few messages from people who want to party with the psychedelics. They want to use the psychedelics for serious personal inquiry.
Mm.
And I see that that happening very strongly amongst the youth today. So that's a very positive thing, and I honor that. Secondly, the question of shamanism, Western shamanism or neo-shamanism. I think it's important to understand, and that's reflected in the questions that get fired at me, that working with psychedelics is a very serious business. This is the other understanding. It's not a party. It's serious work, and it can be alarming. It can be earth-shaking. It can completely change your outlook on life. When you're about to engage in something that has the potential to turn your life upside down and fire you off on a completely different track, it's a good idea to do so in the company of others who know what they're doing. You know, if we want to learn, I mean, this is perhaps not a perfect example, but if we want to learn a martial art, you know, Aikido or something like that, well, we're going to go and find a black belt who's very experienced in that subject to teach us and to share his or her philosophy with us and also his or her skills. And I think it's the same with the deep inquiry into psychedelics, that a teacher is helpful. I don't mean a guru. I'm very opposed to gurus in any shape or form. If there's a guru here, it's the medicine itself, it's the plant, it's the entheogen that is the teacher. But I mean a person who has experience of working with that teacher plant and with the realms that the plants take us into. And that is and always has been the role of the shaman. In traditional societies, in hunter-gatherer societies, the shaman is a person who is deeply versed in the other side, who has gone beyond the veil, not once, not 10 times, but 1,000 times, and explored the realms that lie beyond the veil, and encountered the entities, the fearsome and the loving entities that reside there, and learned to negotiate with them on equal terms. This is the role of the shaman, and that is a role that we do not presently have in Western culture. We are used to things like priests or rabbis or mullahs, you know, who impose themselves between us and the divine, who impose ritual upon us, who tell us basically what to do, and who are actually very alarmed at the notion of any direct experience of the realms beyond. Therefore, we need a new type of person in the West. When I say the West, I'm speaking generally about industrialized technological society, which is a global society now. And that kind of person is not supplied by the mainstream religions. Therefore, we need our own kind of, I can't find any other word, we need our own kind of shamans. And they are people who have learned what goes on the other side. And they've learned it through hard experience. And it has made them humble. If they come back proud, arrogant, seeking to lead some kind of personality cult, then they haven't learned those lessons that are taught on the other side. And they are not suitable figures to lead and guide others through those experiences. The humility of the shaman figure is of vital importance in my view. And we're going through a process now in industrial technological society where individuals are stepping forward and exploring those realms and coming back and offering their services as facilitators of the experience for others. And not all of them are doing a good job. Some of them are doing a really lousy job. And some of them have got hugely inflated egos and are not in that humble space that they need to be in to do this work well. But we're just going to have to work through that. And ultimately, those who really are doing a good job and who have something to offer those who want to learn from these experiences will come to the fore and will have a place in our society. But we're in a time of transition right now. And it's not surprising to me that the good and the bad are present together.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most controversial aspects of ayahuasca culture is definitely the tourism right now that seems to have turned into a booming industry very fast. Do you personally think that there can be solitary drinkers who do not necessarily require shamans? Maybe they do the first time out, but interestingly, the Peruvian curandero Guillermo Arevalo in Rack's book Ayahuasca Sessions, which is forthcoming in May, has admitted that the teacher, the shaman, is not always necessary, that the vine itself, like you say, can act as a guide to the inner planes for the Westerners. And of course, there are dangers with that too, because you sort of throw yourself in the middle of it. Do you want to get into that a bit?
I would say my advice to anybody wanting to go that road would be get some experience first. You know, I did a lot of scuba diving, seven years of scuba diving. I wouldn't have thought of doing solo scuba diving within the first couple of years that I was learning my skills.
Sure.
I think when you're in the skill learning phase, I mean the acquisition of the basic fundamental skills that will help you to survive in a difficult environment, it's very helpful to have a teacher, to have others with you who can support you and pick you up when you go wrong. But I think it is possible, yes, that you reach a certain point where you are ready to go solo. I would not encourage anybody to go solo right away with ayahuasca, just as I would not encourage anybody to go solo right away with scuba diving. But ultimately, the time might come when it's possible to do that. And that then becomes a choice. You know, does one want to take the journey alone with all the challenges and benefits that would bring? Or does one value the social context of the journey? Because in my experience, the social context of drinking ayahuasca is every bit as important as the brew itself. The fact that we are in ceremony, that we are with others, that we are willing to open our hearts to others and be vulnerable in the presence of others and allow them to be vulnerable in our presence. That's a very important part of the ayahuasca teaching. So I wouldn't hasten to set that aside. It might be very interesting to do solo journeys when you're ready, but I wouldn't rush at that gate.
Sure. Do you believe that utilizing some of the sacred narrative that has come to you with ayahuasca visions in fiction, can this narrative be used as a means of combating what you call Frankenstein civilization and sort of the endless consumerism that we find in the Western world? And do you think in this sense that fiction work can also be viewed as a form of political activism? It seems that many people who take up the vine do feel a need to be active about it, outspoken, and there is not necessarily a traditional political activism, but there is an idea of let me try to get this message out to as many people as I possibly can, just because the messages are so revolutionary.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Yes on all counts. I do think that ayahuasca in particular, and more broadly the psychedelics in general, are probably the medicine that technological society needs right now to get away from the hell world that it has created, a hell world that has a stranglehold on all of us, that pins us down into a narrow focus on production and consumption, and onto philosophical materialism, the idea that there is nothing else in reality than material things. This is a very deep and strong underpinning of Western technological society at the moment. It's more powerful than the religious narrative that comes from the monotheistic faiths, as a matter of fact. And this is the faith of science, that everything can be reduced to matter, this is the view of materialist scientists, that there is no such thing as spirit, that we are just our bodies, that consciousness can be reduced to an epiphenomenon of brain activity, and all of that bullshit which we take in with our mother's milk in technological society. Well, psychedelics rip the ground right from under that whole frame of reference, and they show you directly in experience, not in terms of intellectual or rational inquiry, but in experience that hits you in your emotional center, that there is so much more than just the physical body. So, you know, it is that immersion in a subversive experience which the psychedelics offer, and which allows them to serve as an antidote for all the messages that we get in technological and industrial society. And there's really nothing else out there which can offer us that. A lot of people say, oh, you know, why work with psychedelics? Isn't it much more important to just, you know, to do meditation, for example? Well, yeah, I don't see the two things as mutually contradictory. Meditation is a great thing to do. Everybody should do it. But I don't think that we should buy in to the narrative that seeks to present psychedelics as some kind of artificial thing. They are a very fundamental part of the human experience, going back tens of thousands of years. Part of the point I wanted to make in my book, Supernatural, is that our emergence into modern consciousness was almost certainly ushered in by psychedelics. And I know that the late, great Terence McKenna was onto that a very, very, very long time ago. But what I wanted to do in Supernatural was to show that there's good academic work which is being done, which underpins this, which shows that the consciousness expressed in the cave art could not have been expressed without the use of psychedelics, that psychedelics are fundamental to that. So, you know, I think the recognition that what psychedelics can do is take us out of deeply ingrained bad habits, which are so deeply ingrained that we don't even realize they're habits, and throw us into a whole new frame of reference. This is exactly what is needed in global society today, because we are locked into an addiction to old bad habits that don't serve us anymore. And we are told that the only spiritual solace we can seek is through the monotheistic faiths, for example, through Judaism or Christianity or Islam. Psychedelics are coming in from left field and they're saying, no, here is a whole realm of experience that will completely change the way you think about everything. And to that extent, I think their arrival, their re-emergence on the scene of global consciousness in this time, at this moment, is absolutely timely. It really is needed right now that this is happening, and we need to nurture and encourage this, and not allow the media, when there's some accident involving psychedelics, when there's some tragedy or disaster occurs, not allow them to use that to re-demonize psychedelics. You know, of course there will be problems. My goodness, I mean, when people go skydiving, sometimes their parachutes don't work, you know, but that doesn't mean that nobody should go skydiving. And it's the same with psychedelics. Yes, there are risks. Yes, there are downsides. But let's look at the inquiry and the adventure that this is offering to us. So I think that they have a very important role to play. And as a writer, I think it's my responsibility to share my views on that as best as I can, and to make sure that they come through both in my nonfiction and in my fiction writing. Actually, there's no way they couldn't, because as a person, I have been, and as a creative writer, I've been so changed by my work with ayahuasca that it's inevitable that the insights I've received from that work are going to manifest through my writing. Now, whether that will be taken up or liked or appreciated or food for thought for anybody else remains to be seen. But all I can do is just do what I do and do it as well as I can.
Absolutely. Yeah, I feel the same way. Rick Strassman is coming out with a very interesting book, which is the proper sequel to his first book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule, which is called DMT and the Soul of Prophecy. And I was curious, has ayahuasca ever given you any sort of inquiries or visions into the future? I know that prophecy and divination seems to factor into your fiction work, and I was curious if this has been directly instigated by ayahuasca.
Well, firstly, it's important to be clear, when Rick speaks of prophecy, he isn't only talking about foretelling the future. Hmm. He's speaking of prophecy in a much broader sense than that, of speaking out the visionary experience,
sure,
which can include an element of foretelling the future.
Sure.
The only thing I would say, the only specific example I can give you from my own work, is that when I came to write my first novel, which is called Entangled, and which as I mentioned earlier, has one character in the Stone Age and one character in the 21st century. The role of the Neanderthals was key part of the Stone Age story that I'm telling in Entangled. And the origin of all of this was a series of visions that I had with ayahuasca in Brazil in 2007. And what I was shown in those visions that was that the Neanderthals were not as I had previously thought them to be. If you read my book Supernatural, which was published in 2005, you'll find that I give the Neanderthals a pretty rough ride. I bought into the view that they were not really fully conscious in the way that anatomically modern humans are conscious, that they weren't creative, that they lacked spirituality. All of that paradigm about Neanderthals, which was the mainstream academic view in the early 2000s when I was writing Supernatural, is present in Supernatural. What happened to me in those visions in 2007 was a kind of revelation. I was shown that the Neanderthals were completely different from the way that I had treated them before. And as a matter of fact, I had an apology to deliver. I had to show the Neanderthals in a completely different way. I had to recognize their huge creative power, their amazing capacity for love and goodness and decency, their healing abilities, their telepathic powers. All of this was shown to me. I had to indicate that there had been the possibility of relationships and of families between Neanderthals and anatomically modern humans, which wasn't considered possible in 2005. I was shown that the Neanderthals had red hair. I was shown that they were the ones who taught our ancestors how to paint. All of this I expressed in my book Entangled, and all of this came out in the academic record after I'd written Entangled, that this new view of the Neanderthals that we now have. So in that sense, I suppose I was given some information which later turned out to be supported by academic research, and I was given it ahead of that research, and the information changed my whole track in the way that I regarded the Neanderthals. So I wouldn't call that prophecy, but I would call it insight into a mystery in our past, which I had not had before, and which subsequently turned out to be verified and supported by the latest academic research, and which I manifested and expressed through my book, because the Neanderthals play an absolutely key role in that book and in the battle of good against evil. There's no doubt on which side they stand. They stand on the side of the light and on the side of the good.
Hmm. Now, is this something that do you feel you'll get more into in the sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods, which won't be out, I don't think, until 2015?
Yes, so we're changing track now, because yes. Fingerprints of the Gods is my nonfiction, my best-known nonfiction book, which was published in 1995, mm-hmm. and which presents the evidence for Earth's lost civilization, for the possibility that there's been a huge forgotten episode in human history, that there might have been something that by any useful meaning of the term we must call a civilization more than 12,000 years ago, which was brought to an end cataclysmically in the extraordinary events that accompanied the end of the last
which episode. I think too the book Forbidden Archaeology by Michael Cremo just solidifies, because that book is so in depth that some of the archaeological cover-ups that have happened over time.
Yeah, I know Michael, he's a fantastic researcher, and his book goes into just huge depth over how the history that we've been given as quote unquote fact is actually a story.
Yep.
That has been made up by a very small elite group of academics, mm-hmm. Who have systematically removed the evidence that doesn't fit the story they want to tell. Michael Cremo's book goes into a huge range of subjects that I actually don't explore in Fingerprints of the Gods. Fingerprints is very focused on one specific issue, which was there a civilization, something that at least had the capacity to explore the world, to make maps of the world, to engage in large-scale constructions 12,000 or so years ago. And that book was published in 1995. It came in for an enormous amount of academic criticism, which I wasn't really prepared for. I learned a lot of lessons from that book, but when I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods, I think I was rather naive. I just thought, hey, this is really interesting. There is another way to look at the past. You know, we don't have to look at it the way we've been told. One can take the same data that the archaeologists are working with and realize that a completely different story can emerge from that. But but by doing that, my great crime in writing Fingerprints of the Gods was that the book was successful. It was a number one bestseller in, you know, half a dozen countries or more. It sold 5 million copies around the world. That brought it to the attention of the academic lobby. If the book had just failed and vanished without a trace, I wouldn't have received any criticism. But because the book was prominent and because students were reading it and approaching their lecturers about it, I was hugely attacked, not just for my ideas, but me as an individual, my integrity, my honor was attacked, sometimes in incredibly vile and deeply underhand ways.
Sure.
That in a way, with my subsequent nonfiction, made me more defensive as a writer, always looking for the counterargument, always looking to bulletproof every point that is made. And, you know, if you went with the mainstream outcry that reacted to my book Fingerprints of the Gods in 1995, by 1999 or the year 2000, if you went with the mainstream, you would believe that nothing in the book could stand up, that it was just a pointless exercise in imagination by Hancock. Hancock's idea that civilization was much older and much more mysterious than we'd previously imagined just had to be wrong. And one of the magazines that attacked me in that way and said precisely that was a magazine in Britain called New Scientist. So I was absolutely delighted when in 2013, October 2013, New Scientist published a cover story with the headline, Civilization is Much Older and Much More Mysterious Than We Thought. Because the fact is that since the late 1990s, huge amounts of new evidence have been coming out that call into question the whole narrative that we've been given. And this evidence is so overwhelming that it's impossible for mainstream academia to ignore it. And quite a bit of it is coming out of mainstream academia itself. Now, it's a very gradual process. It was a very gradual process when the Ptolemaic model of the solar system was overthrown by the heliocentric model. It took a long time for right-minded people back in the 16th and 15th, 16th, 17th centuries to actually accept that the Earth went round the sun.
Sure.
Previously, all their observations had convinced them that the sun went around the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But little by little, the new evidence kept on coming in, which could not be explained by the Ptolemaic theory. And eventually, the Ptolemaic theory fell and was replaced by the Copernican theory. And I see the same thing happening with our understanding of our past, with sites like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, which is incontrovertibly more than 12,000 years old and takes the form of gigantic megalithic architecture and a huge project of organization and of skill, the work of a civilization by any standards. When I consider sites like Gunung Padang in Indonesia, where I was in December and where I'm going to be again at the end of May, which looks like it may be as much as 20,000 years old. When I consider the evidence that the Earth was struck by a giant fragmenting comet about 12,980 years ago, 10,980 BC, initiating an event called the Younger Dryas, where the Earth that was just emerging from the Ice Age went back into a sudden catastrophic deep freeze. That's, for me, the smoking gun. That is the event that wiped out a whole chapter in our story, which we are now trying to recover and which the evidence is coming out for. So that's what I am going to be focusing on in the sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods, which I hope will be published in late 2015. It's an enormous undertaking. I'm aiming to write a completely new book presenting all of the new evidence. And certainly, yes, everything that I learned about the so-called Stone Age when I was writing about shamanism and altered states of consciousness in Supernatural will be brought to bear on this new inquiry. Because one thing is becoming clear is that you cannot divorce entheogens from ancient civilizations. All of the great ancient civilizations that we know within the historical record, never mind before it, were definitely exploring visionary states of consciousness. And the evidence, once you have understood visionary states of consciousness yourself, the evidence for this is absolutely manifest and clear in the historical record. The problem is that most archaeologists haven't had those experiences, so they don't recognize what they're looking at. But it's there, and it's part of our story. And I aim to show that it's been part of our story as a species from the get-go.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you critical about the ancient alien theory? I know you get into this a bit in Supernatural. You feel that aliens are both, they can physicalize, but they're also interdimensional. Is this theory something that will also play in Magicians of the Gods? And do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. Magicians of the Gods is the working title that I have for the sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods. And I will give, within the overall book that I'm going to write there, I will give a part of it to a detailed and I hope fair-minded consideration of what is called the ancient astronaut or the ancient alien hypothesis. I tell you where I stand at the moment on this. Having spent the last 25 years, approximately, traveling the world, visiting an incredible number of ancient and mysterious sites, getting to grips with the Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt and getting to know it really well, climbing it 5 times, exploring every known passageway and corridor within the Great Pyramid, including many that are completely off limits to the public. I haven't found any single object or artifact in my 25 years of inquiry that could only be explained by an extraterrestrial visitation. Not one. What I found is huge anomalies, which are more simply and more easily explained by the notion of a lost human civilization. I often point this out, but it's worth pointing it out again. The ancient alien lobby naturally takes the Great Pyramid as its ultimate object to prove the ancient alien hypothesis. Look, if you've come here from the Sirius star system, or from the Orion star system, come to that, you've crossed interstellar space. If you've crossed interstellar space, your navigation is really, really good. To cross interstellar space and to end up on this pale blue dot, this little thing that we call the Earth, to actually find it and land on it, you have got navigation really sorted out. Okay, so that's why I have a problem with the fact that the Great Pyramid is 3/60 of a single degree off true north. It's incredible accuracy for human workmanship. It's accuracy beyond what we are taught was available to the ancient Egyptians in 2500 BC. But it isn't spot on. It's slightly off. And the side lengths of the Great Pyramid vary by as much as 7 inches. That's not much on a side length of 750 feet, but it's still an error. And I think if you've got the technology to cross interstellar space and the Great Pyramid is your project, I think it aligns perfectly to true north. And I think the sides are all the same length. what I see in the Great Pyramid is the fingerprints of a lost human civilization, not of extraterrestrials who've come here from another planet. Now, maybe they got marooned here if they came at that particular window in our history around 2500 BC. Maybe they got marooned here and they had to do the best with the skills they had. They lost their technology, and maybe that would explain it. One could go with that. But then one has to understand why this presence that is construed as alien manifests in many other periods of history as well, like thousands of years before in the painted caves. That doesn't look like a marooning. That looks like a long-term relationship. And if there's a long-term relationship with beings who can get here from another planet in another star system, who can cross interstellar space, then it puzzles me that they can't get their navigational directions right for a thing like the Great Pyramid. Actually, I think that, in a way, the ancient astronaut lobby, which takes the form almost of a modern religion, mm-hmm. A faith, which, if you question it, can result in... I mean, I thought the archaeologists were vicious when they attacked me. But I must say that those who belong to the ancient alien faith are much more vicious,
sure.
Towards anybody who questions their paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think that what they're doing is they're trivializing a mystery. I think the mystery is there. I understand what they're reacting to. There is a huge problem in our past and a huge question mark over what we are and what we're doing here. But just because we happen to be of the generation that has started sending tin rockets into space doesn't mean that the answer to that mystery is more sophisticated tin rockets.
Mm.
It might be much deeper than that. It might go far beyond anything to do with that. You know, people say to me, Sirius and Orion play a huge role in ancient Egyptian mythology. This must mean that beings came here from Sirius and Orion. Sirius is 8 light years away. Beta Orionis is nearly 900 light years away.
Mm.
These two objects in the sky appear very close when you look at them in the sky. But in real space, they're hundreds of light years apart. So any connection that you make between them has to take into account the most obvious connection, which is that they're actually really close to each other in the visual sky, but very far away in the actual universe. And it's not a good argument, in my view, to say that because they feature prominently in ancient Egyptian mythology, it must mean that beings from planets around those stars came here. If they came from both stars, we don't just have one amazing thing happening, we have two amazing things happening, because how can those two very distant star systems be separated? Well, I can think of be connected. I can think of lots of ways that they might be connected, but all I'm trying to do is to point out some logical problems in this hypothesis. Furthermore, the other problem I have with the ancient alien religion is that it is at root deeply materialistic.
Hmm.
It wants to, just like those materialist scientists who say that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the brain, the ancient alien religion wants to reduce everything to matter. It wants to say that physical beings, a bit like you and me, but with higher tech, which tech might be used for all kinds of nefarious or positive purposes, but with higher tech, have come here and interacted with human beings. If you say to them that actually the encounters that we have on the record with beings that are construed as aliens are incredibly similar to the encounters that people have in deeply altered states of consciousness, why, the ancient alien religion gets really angry about that.
Mm.
And it's actually often deeply dismissive of altered states of consciousness and refers to it as people taking drugs and, you know, how right. can people taking drugs have any useful ideas? Of course it's high-tech aliens coming here from other planets.
Right.
Not considering the role of consciousness in this at all. You know, Jung, who wrote a book about flying saucers in the 1950s, had a really interesting point to make. and it's a point that I can't ignore, which is that the UFO phenomenon, the flying saucer phenomenon, does have a physical element to it. I'd be a fool to deny that. There is a physical element to it. Sometimes there is a trace on a radar screen. What about all those individuals who do have physical implants in their bodies, in their ears? I know a person who has one. I've seen the implant. This is physical. This is real. But Jung also pointed out that it's, in his view, a 99% psychic phenomenon and a 1% physical phenomenon. And that low ratio of physical to psychic might explain why it's such an elusive phenomenon and such a difficult phenomenon to pin down. The point that I'm making is we're never going to get to grips with this mystery. There is a mystery. There is a phenomenon. Huge numbers of people have had the experience of being abducted by what they construe as aliens and UFOs. We can't deny that. It's a fact. But what is going on? That's the question. That's the question that's not resolved, and that the ancient alien lobby is just jumping to an incredibly easy, simplistic, materialistic conclusion. So, alternative hypothesis. Maybe we're dealing with interdimensional encounters. Maybe that's what's going on here. And maybe it has indeed been going on throughout human history. Maybe these entities are, as I said in the subtitle to my book, Supernatural, maybe they are the ancient teachers of mankind. But to just reduce them to physical beings in this physical universe, a nuts and bolts explanation, something just like us but with higher tech, first of all, it raises lots of questions which are very difficult to answer satisfactorily. And secondly, it's too simple, too easy, and doesn't do justice to the grandeur and the scale of the mystery that we're confronted with. So I would like to see the UFO disclosure alien lobby embracing consciousness research as well. And here I'm summarizing what was said to Rick Strassman by a number of his volunteers when they reported their experiences in DMT space, was that they met entities who said to them, "We're so glad you've discovered this technology. Now we can communicate with you more easily." I think if we're going to get to grips with the phenomenon that is presently labeled alien and UFO abductions, and in the historical frame is labeled as the ancient astronaut theory, I think we're going to have to do a lot more work with consciousness. And I think the entheogens, notably DMT and ayahuasca, can be our biggest allies in doing this work. And I want to explore all of this. And I'm willing to challenge my own prejudices in this field in the exploration that I'm going to do in Magicians of the Gods.
Absolutely. Well, I cannot wait for these two books. So we have the sequel to War God,
yes,
and also Magicians of the Gods, which is coming out in 2015. War God, the sequel to War God, will be coming out late this year in October,
October 2013, October 2014, and that is called War God, Return of the Plumed Serpent. The first volume is called War God, Knights of the Witch.
Absolutely. Well, Graham, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's a lot of information to download, but I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been absolutely great.
I've enjoyed talking to you. Keep well.
All right. Thank you very much.
See ya.